From the BBC in London, this is Robin Lustig with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the confrontation in Romania between striking miners and the security forces continues. But the government's threat to impose an immediate state of emergency has been lifted. We'll be hearing live from Bucharest and analysing what's behind this explosion of social unrest. In London, five Western powers and Russia are meeting to discuss the crisis in the Serbian province of Kosovo. For now, they're talking about political, not military, solutions. And we report from India on the growing concern about the sexual abuse of children by members of their own families.
Every time my parents went out for a party, the bastard used to do it.
First, the news in detail. It's read by Ian Purton.
The Romanian president, Emil Constantinescu, has postponed the deadline set for coal miners to end their march on the capital, Bucharest. He said in a statement he wanted to ensure a favorable climate for the government's negotiations with the miners, but that a state of emergency could still be declared if talks are not successful. So far, there's been no indication of any progress. Nick Thorpe has just sent this report.
By meeting the miners, Prime Minister Radu Vasile has satisfied one of their demands, that he should conduct negotiations with them in person. He's leading a delegation which includes his finance minister and a bishop who comes originally from the miners' region in the hills of western Romania. The talks are taking place in a monastery close to Râmnicu Vâlcea, where the miners spent last night. The mood among the miners this morning was one of impatience. On the fifth day of their journey to the capital, they appear determined to press ahead, despite President Emil Constantinescu's threat of a state of emergency. The president said he had temporarily postponed its introduction while he awaits the outcome of the talks. The rest of the country is holding its breath. In the capital, Bucharest, a march of several thousand people, including writers, poets and politicians, marched in favour of reforms in defence of the government.
Senior officials of five Western powers and Russia have begun talks in London aimed at resolving the conflict in the Serbian province of Kosovo. The BBC diplomatic correspondent says Western leaders want to inject new life into the political process in Kosovo. Speaking before the meeting, the British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook said detailed proposals for a settlement would be considered, but that NATO remained ready to use military force. A court in France is due to announce verdicts today in the case of more than 130 people accused of supporting Islamic radicals seeking to overthrow the Algerian government. The defendants and their lawyers have boycotted much of the proceedings in protest against the way France's anti-terrorism laws were applied. Here's Stephen Jessel.
The trial of the 138 was conducted in a prison service gymnasium just across the road from a large prison complex on the outskirts of Paris. Both the setting and the number of defendants led to a boycott of the proceedings by most defendants and defence lawyers, though even in their absence the trial lasted 2 months. The defendants were accused under anti-terrorist legislation on a general charge of criminal association in connection with a terrorist enterprise. It's alleged that they belong to one or more of three networks of radical Islamists, giving material and logistical support to armed groups in Algeria. They were arrested over a two-year period, and the specific allegations against them vary widely. Misgivings about the trial were expressed at the time, and this week a two-man investigating team from an international human rights body attacked the way France's anti-terrorist legislation, introduced in 1986, has been applied by judges and magistrates.
A second member of the International Olympic Committee has resigned over bribery allegations connected with Salt Lake City's successful bid for the Winter Games in 2002. The Libyan delegate Bashir Mohamed Atarabulsi stepped down following disclosures that his son had received scholarships from Salt Lake City. Claire Dool reports.
Mr. Atarabulsi, who served on the Olympic Committee's executive board for the past 22 years, handed in his resignation in person. The president of the IOC, Juan Antonio Samaranch, said the Libyan delegate stepped down because of revelations his son had received college scholarships to schools in the U.S. state of Utah from sponsors of the Salt Lake City's bid to stage the 2002 Winter Games. His resignation follows that of a Finnish IOC member, Pio Hagman, earlier in the week, following revelations of her husband's link with the Salt Lake City Organizing Committee. The resignations come a day before a special IOC commission meets to conclude its inquiry into the Olympics' biggest corruption scandal.
Pope John Paul is on his way to Mexico, his fourth visit to the country. Millions of pilgrims are converging on Mexico City to welcome him. During his visit, the Pope is due to outline the future strategy of the Roman Catholic Church in the Americas. A correspondent for the BBC in Mexico says the speculation about whether the Pope will comment on the forced closure by paramilitary groups of some 40 Catholic churches in the troubled state of Chiapas. The government accuses a prominent bishop in Chiapas of supporting the uprising there by Zapatista rebels. A group of 40 foreigners has been evacuated from the Indonesian island of Ambon following riots between Christians and Muslims. The Australian immigration authorities say the group, including 20 Americans and 11 Britons, were from a Christian organisation based in Ambon. They were flown to Australia on two chartered planes. 3 days of violence in Ambon and nearby islands have left at least 22 dead. BBC World Service News.
Just over an hour ago, the deadline set by the Romanian president for coal miners to end their attempt to march on the capital, Bucharest, came and went. But the threat to impose a state of emergency has been lifted, at least for now. The Prime Minister and the miners' leader have been locked in talks. 10,000 miners are camped less than 200 kilometres from the capital. Well, on the line now from Bucharest is our correspondent Ruslan Scorcia from the BBC's Romanian service. Ruslan, what's the feeling there in the capital at the moment? Do you think the miners are going to make it to Bucharest?
Well, nobody really knows. I think Miron Cosma, the miners' leader, is probably the only man who can stop the miners if he wants to. But these miners gathered in a town about 200 kilometres north of Bucharest don't seem to be prepared to accept any compromise at the moment. When they were told of the Prime Minister's offer of negotiation, they booed, they sat down with the government and shouted, Bucharest, Bucharest.
What do you make then of the President's decision at least to suspend the threat to impose a state of emergency?
Well, the President's communique is very clear. He says he will suspend the threat, but he will suspend the coming into force of the state of emergency until the end of the negotiations. If the negotiations fail, the state of emergency will come into force automatically.
I'm trying to get from you now some sense of the danger that this crisis poses to the government. Is it seen in Bucharest as a political event or simply something confined to the miners and those who live and work with them?
Absolutely. The government, the authorities believe this is a politically motivated march, a politically motivated protest. Indeed, the leader of the miners is a member of a far-right party called the Party of Greater Romania. The authorities accused the opposition of inciting the miners. So definitely this is much more than a simple union protest.
And is it possible to gauge whether there is popular support for them? I mean, from those not directly involved in the mining community?
Once again, it's difficult to say. There are communiques from all sorts of unions around the country saying they support the miners, not necessarily their march to Bucharest. They support what the miners want, their demands. But the population at large, it's difficult to say. Certainly, one thing is clear. Many Bucharest citizens, an opinion poll showed that 90% of the Bucharest citizens do not want the miners to come.
What we're depending on now then, what the people of Bucharest are depending on, is a successful outcome to these talks between the Prime Minister and the miners' leader. That could go on for some time.
They could, and the negotiations will no doubt be extremely difficult. The miners have a list of 30 demands. They're insisting now only on two, a 35% pay rise, a reversal of a government decision to close down a number of inefficient mines. But the government is desperately trying not to give in on this, because if they do, many other people, many other unions will ask for more money. They will oppose the closing down of the inefficient state enterprises of the communist era. The whole government reform program could be compromised.
Ruslan Scorcia in Bucharest, thank you very much. Well, with me now here in the studio is the Romania analyst Denis Deletant from the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at London University. Professor Deletant, clearly there must be a political dimension to this. Just how much of a political dimension?
Well, as your correspondent in Bucharest pointed out, Răzvan, there are close links between the miners' leader, Miron Cosma, and the Greater Romanian Party, which is led by Corneliu Vadim Tudor, which is a party of the extreme right, which has very close links with the party of Monsieur Le Pen in France. Miron Cosma himself was arrested in January 97 for taking part in the miners' incursion in Bucharest in September 91, and he was in fact held for more than a year. He eventually was sentenced to 18 months imprisonment for illegal possession of firearms and commandeering trains during the September 91 excursion. But this has left him very bitter towards the government, and his bitterness has been exploited by the extreme right party.
Ought we, though, do you think, to look at this in the context of the upheaval that there has been throughout Eastern Europe in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet bloc, an inevitable part of this wholesale economic reform process?
It is part of that, but I think the miners are a special case in Romania. They did voice the only organised workers' opposition to the Ceausescu regime in 1977. And they therefore feel that they have a special case. In the summer of 97, Constantin Nescu went to the Jiu Valley and launched this redundancy scheme for the miners. In fact, some of the pits which were scheduled to be closed were then not closed. But what's happened is, although a considerable number of miners have taken the redundancy payments, the value of those payments has been eroded very rapidly over the last couple of months because of the fall in the value of the local currency, and the miners have become embittered. The government has promised regeneration schemes in the miners' area, but nothing has come of them, and the miners are very sceptical that they will ever find work again if their pits are closed.
We saw some very violent scenes yesterday when the miners broke through those police blockades on their way towards Bucharest. Today, it looks, the talks have been going on for several hours. The president has pulled back from this threat to impose an immediate state of emergency. Is there any real spirit of compromise?
I think there will ultimately be compromise because Cosma has been to Bucharest twice before. He may wish to come on the third occasion. On both the previous occasions, the government was teetering. In one case, in fact, the Prime Minister was forced to resign. So he may have on his agenda the toppling of this present government, as your correspondent said, in Bucharest. But I think the key to the issue is whether or not the demonstrations that we've seen in Bucharest capital, which has a population of 2 million, ram home the point to the miners that if they do get there, they're going to face possibly a battle with the civilian population of Bucharest.
Professor Dennis Dalatant, many thanks. In France, verdicts are to be handed down shortly in the country's largest and most controversial trial of alleged Islamic militants. Nearly 150 people, alleged to have been members of the so-called Islamic Underground, have been on trial, accused of supporting Islamic radicals seeking to overthrow the government in Algeria. But right from the beginning of the proceedings, there has been criticism of the way the judicial system was being used. Well, on the line now from Paris is our correspondent, Stephen Jessel. Stephen, tell us just a little bit more about exactly what this criticism entailed.
Well, the criticism has many aspects to it. Let's begin with the setting of the trial, which was in a prison service gymnasium separated only by a road from one of the biggest prison complexes in France. That is not exactly the setting where you would expect free and untrammeled justice to be handed out. But the more serious charge against this trial is that it's lumped together 138 different people arrested at different times in different places, all or most of them under a catch-all charge of criminal association with a terrorist enterprise. They are alleged to have belonged to one or more rings supplying logistical and material support to the rebels or to the forces in Algeria trying to overthrow the government. The criticism is that it's a mass trial, something of a show trial, in circumstances which make it impossible for justice to be done.
How much worry has this criticism caused to the authorities? I mean, do you think they're likely to do the same thing again if the need arises?
No, I think there is considerable unease about this trial. The verdicts, all 138 of them, and possible sentences are due to be delivered within the next few hours. Presumably that will take some time. And I should point out that the proceedings were boycotted by most of the defendants most of the time, and practically all the defense lawyers practically all of the time. But there have been, it's been made clear that this is not the sort of thing that is going to happen again. And it coincides with very trenchant criticism of France's anti-terrorism legislation in a report issued only yesterday.
We'll leave it there. Stephen Jessel in Paris, thank you. Coming up next in NewsHour, we report from India on growing concern there about the sexual abuse of children within their own families. And we'll be hearing from Beijing about problems in the banks. They've been lending out too much money, which they are unlikely to get back. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig. This is NewsHour. A reminder of our main headline, the Romanian president has suspended his threat to impose a state of emergency as the confrontation continues between the government and thousands of striking miners. In India, a group which has been investigating the sexual abuse of children says it has found that incest is far more widespread than is usually suspected. The group, RAHI, which stands for Recovering and Healing from Incest, says huge numbers of women have suffered sexual abuse as children, even though most Indians think that incest is a Western problem, confined to countries with what they regard as a permissive attitude towards sex, like in Britain and the United States. But as our correspondent Daniel Lack has been finding out, the reality looks rather different. In his report, the voices of some of the people he spoke to have been changed to protect their identities.
It's just before morning classes outside one of Delhi's top schools for girls. These pupils are from India's elite, middle class and rich, the daughters of successful business people, politicians and civil servants. They seem the perfect picture of modern India, traditional family values blending effortlessly with the benefits of the global economy, guaranteeing them a happy, prosperous future.
Every time my parents went out for a party, the bastard used to do it. Thank God it didn't happen more than twice.
When I told people in my family about the abuse, there was hostility, contempt and anger targeted at me. I became an outcast.
I sometimes wonder, is there no part of my body or soul that was untouched by the abuse that I can call my own?
The real voices of this and other schoolyards around urban India. In this case, actresses reading the written comments of women remembering the most horrid imaginable experiences. Sexual assault by a close relative. A shocking new report from the Delhi organization RAHI shows how well India's traditional family structure has concealed an alarming amount of sexual abuse of children and teenage girls. Listen to the real voice, changed to protect her identity, of this survivor. We'll call her Aisha.
And it was 1st of Jan, 1993, now I remember. That's when this episode happened, and I realized. But I didn't tell anybody because I was too shocked and too confused. And at that point in time, I could not relate to the previous incidences, the incidences that have happened over the years. At that point of time, I only knew of this incident that had happened where he tried to sort of rape me. He knew very well that I loved him, that I trusted him beyond any imagination. And that is what hurt me, you know, the most, that he used me, he just tore me apart. He just sort of, you know, everything that he did for me was with an intention of using me.
So I think I'll first see what needs to be done and then I'll explain it.
Aisha's story and her feelings are all too familiar to the people who work in Rahi's suburban Delhi office. Anuja Gupta founded RAHI because she believed sexual abuse was rampant in Indian families and no one was doing anything about it.
When I started working in this area, people always used to ask me, well, where are the Indian statistics? You know, and this is, incest is a Western phenomenon and this happens in America because American is, you know, it's a promiscuous society. And one of the reasons why there hasn't been any data collection or any surveys or studies in this is simply because it's not considered to be an Indian problem at all.
Her report, called Voices from the Silent Zone, suggests that nearly three-quarters of upper and middle-class Indian women are abused by a family member, most often an uncle, cousin, or elder brother. In Aisha's case, it was a cousin's husband, a man who became her mentor and eventually her abuser.
He was teaching me and I was wearing a kurta. It is purple in color and, you know, it had those buttons which stick, just open, snap off like that. And my bracelet got stuck in somewhere between the buttons, and as I was just moving my hand, you know, all the buttons just opened, and in sheer embarrassment and not knowing what to do, I just sort of covered myself. He kept continuing to teach me, and I was red, hot, and very embarrassed and wondering how do I, you know, button myself up, and in what seemed like an hour, came to me and he just licked my cheek, you know, a very lingering kind of lick that I feel went on for God knows how many minutes. And without saying a word, he just walked out of the room.
Incest and child sexual abuse occurs everywhere. The particular problem in India, according to psychiatrist Achal Bhagat, is that the concept of family is almost sacred, and abuse, if it happens, is met with disbelief, denial, and cover-up.
I think there's a great myth about Indian family systems as being very supportive. What happens is that when you are a family, what do you do? I mean, if you're the mother in that family where your child is being abused, and if you recognize your brother-in-law or your husband has been abusing the child, you do not have that much power to do anything about the system. But generally, there is this thing about you might harm the name of the family if you talk about certain things in openly. So this need to prevent the family from being laughed at leads to a lot of cover-ups.
Voices from the Silent Zone pinpoints another problem facing victims of abuse in India, the complete absence of any structure outside the family to help those who suffer from abuse. As a psychiatrist specializing in such cases, Achal Bhagat says he often faces the grimmest of choices when considering how to help the victim.
What if not the family? Where are the other support systems? They aren't any existent. And there might be a few NGOs working in the field. There are three or four working in the whole of India. But can they actually provide the support systems? And the juvenile homes or Nari Niketans in the Indian setup, the social support system, is so lacking and so insensitive to the needs of such children that I wouldn't be sure what is more abusive, staying on in the abusive family or the environment which the system would put them in.
Aisha's interview for this report was groundbreaking for her, and her counselor was closely involved in it. So is it true that speaking about abuse helps you deal with it?
No, I feel good after this interview because it's the first time that I've actually spoken about it in such a structured fashion, in a very thought out fashion, where I've given it a thought and I've given words to my feelings, to my past. I feel good, I feel I've arrived.
The experiences of some women who've suffered sexual abuse. That report was by Daniel Lack. There is growing concern in China that the country's banks could soon be in real trouble after lending out huge sums of money which they are unlikely to be able to get back. According to the World Bank, the whole of China's banking and financial system is under severe stress. And with continuing fears about the economic and financial crisis in Brazil, world markets are anxious to prevent a similar crisis in China. So on the line to Beijing, I asked the China specialist John Gittings of the Guardian newspaper, how serious now are the fears of a Chinese banking crisis?
It's not so much that there will be a sudden collapse. The problem is what to do about the internal debt. These banks have been lending money too freely for the last 4 or 5 years, ever since the late Deng Xiaoping launched the second wave of economic reform. And what they've been doing is using the ordinary Chinese customers' money to finance unwise projects. The government is beginning to do something about it, but that is by far a bigger problem than the currency, the renminbi, or the investment and trust corporations which have borrowed money also unwisely from abroad.
Now, unless something can be done to bring this under control, what effect could it have on the Chinese economy as a whole?
Well, nothing in China is ever quite so dramatic as we think it's been to be, and that applies to this as well. It's more the Chinese are caught in a contradiction here, because on the one hand, they want to stimulate the economy by pumping more money into more projects, and actually that means, among other things, getting the banks to start lending more again. On the other hand, they want to try to sort out the financial chaos. And they want to restrain unwise projects. In fact, in the last couple of weeks, there has been huge concern growing over projects which have been financed and without proper supervision, where shoddy, unqualified construction companies have made a quick buck and passed some of that on to local officials.
Is it possible, I mean, looking at the political consequences of this, is it possible that some of those in China who have never been convinced of the case for the sort of economic reforms which the country has seen over recent years might use this sort of problem as a way of arguing that things have now gone too far?
Well, what the leadership is doing is, in a sense, partly defensive in order to forestall that argument. It's an argument which has been made by the people we call, sometimes we call them conservatives, sometimes we call them leftists, are the ones who say that things have gone too far. Certainly, the old idea that when you open the window to reform and market economics, a bit of dirt comes in from outside and that's no bad thing. That idea is no longer tolerated. They're not going to tolerate the dirt and the muck of corruption and shoddy building. At the same time, they've got to keep the economy going, and they've got to try to revive consumption. Consumption is falling. People are buying fewer things this year than they did last year, and fewer than the year before. And so that we're back with the same contradiction of pumping more money in. Another contradiction is that they are trying to reform state-owned industries so they're more efficient and employ fewer people. So they are putting those people out of work. But in order to create jobs for them, they have to invent jobs elsewhere. And if you go into department stores in Beijing now, you find they're full of people behind counters with nothing to do once again, because the department stores have been asked to take on more staff.
John Gittings of The Guardian on the line there from Beijing. Well, more from the world of finance now, and with the crisis in Brazil still not over, Argentina has unveiled a plan to adopt the US dollar as its national currency. With more on that and the rest of the day's financial news, here's Russell Padmore.
The influential international financier George Soros says he believes the continuing upward trend in share prices in New York is threatening the stability of the world's financial system. Mr. Soros has told an international conference American consumers are spending more than they're earning. He warned the so-called asset bubble cannot last forever. As Brazil's economic crisis continues, Argentina has revealed it's considering adopting the US dollar as its currency. The president of Argentina's central bank says it may introduce a radical monetary treaty with the United States. The treaty is designed to prevent all risk of devaluation. Our correspondent in Buenos Aires, James Reynolds, has been telling me the scheme has provoked a mixed reaction.
The newspapers have it all over their front page. They're negotiating an agreement with the United States, is what one paper, Clarín, says. Politicians from the opposition alliance have criticized any move to adopt the dollar as a single currency. Former President Raul Alfonsín said he would not want to see the government give up control of its national monetary policy.
What would be the advantages to Argentina of actually using the US dollar as its currency?
The government says that it would provide greater stability and greater economic integration. It would remove, at a stroke, worries about devaluation, which, of course, are very prevalent at the moment with the after effects of the Brazilian crisis.
If a monetary treaty is introduced, is it open to other South American nations to also sign up?
This is what Carlos Menem would like. Last week, of course, he said that the whole of Latin America should adopt the dollar as a single currency by the year 2005. This was widely dismissed by many economists as far-fetched, but he is keen not just to adopt the dollar in Argentina, but to start the ball rolling and hope that it stretches to other countries as well.
James Reynolds in Buenos Aires monitoring reaction to Argentina's idea to adopt the US dollar as its currency. There's more speculation about the possibility of a merger in the car industry today. The German automotive manufacturer Daimler Chrysler has been talking with Nissan about the possibility of taking a stake in the Japanese company. The two have been negotiating with each other for more than a year. Japan's second biggest car producer, Nissan, is heavily in debt. Within an hour, when the New York market opens, the international financial focus will be on Brazil's ailing currency. The real slipped to a new low of 172 against the US dollar yesterday. The latest from the financial markets now. London's 100 share index is currently lower at 58.59. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei index closed lower at 14,154. In London currency trading, the US dollar is worth 114 Japanese yen. The euro is trading at $1.15.6 and the pound is worth $1.65.1.
Russell, thanks very much indeed. That was Russell Padmore with all of the business news.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. It's just coming up to 1:30 the hour. Just time for me to remind you that we always like to hear what you think of our programmes or of the issues that we discuss in them. So why not drop us a line? Our address is NewsHour, BBC World Service, Bush House, London. And our email address, if you have access to the internet, newshour@bbc.co.uk. newshour@bbc.co.uk. Coming up in the next half hour of this edition of the programme, two journalists in Zimbabwe talk publicly about the treatment which they suffered in military custody. We report on the war of words in Kosovo after the allegations of a massacre a week ago. We hear the latest from Washington on the Clinton impeachment trial. And we talk to a doctor who's heading off to the Philippines to put smiles on the faces of children born with serious facial deformities. Now let's have a summary of the latest news from Ian Purdon.
The Romanian president, Emil Constantinescu, has postponed the deadline set for thousands of striking miners to end their march on the capital, Bucharest. He said he wanted to ensure a favourable climate for the government's negotiations with the miners. The focus of efforts to resolve the conflict in the Serbian province of Kosovo has switched to London, with talks involving five Western powers and Russia. The British Foreign Secretary has said NATO remains ready to use military force. A court in France is due to announce verdicts today after a mass trial involving 138 defendants. They're accused of supporting Islamic radicals seeking to overthrow the Algerian government. Another member of the International Olympic Committee has resigned over bribery allegations linked to the holding of the Winter Games in Salt Lake City in 2002. The latest person to go is a long-time IOC member, Bashir Mohamed Atarabusti of Libya. The two Zimbabwean journalists who say they were tortured in detention after publishing a story about an alleged coup plot say their interrogators suspected a South African link. They said the military saw a connection between their story and a South African military intelligence report of a coup plot in Zimbabwe. Pope John Paul is on his way to Mexico. It's his fourth visit to the country. Millions of pilgrims are converging on Mexico City to welcome him. King Norodom Sihanouk of Cambodia has called on the Prime Minister Hun Sen to save the country's national heritage by stopping the theft and smuggling of ancient artefacts. The king expressed concern at recent reports of the theft of carvings and statues from Cambodian temples. He described this as a serious problem. And an explosion in a cinema in the southwestern Chinese city of Yibin has killed one man and left five people injured. Reports say that the man deliberately set off a bomb strapped to his waist. Police in China are currently investigating a string of explosions across the country, including two bomb blasts on buses.
Ian, thank you. Well, more now on the crisis in Romania, where thousands of coal miners are threatening to march on the capital. On the line now from the president's office in Bucharest is the presidential advisor, Zoe Petre. Ms. Petre, the crisis is not yet over. How hopeful are you and your colleagues that it can be resolved peacefully?
We are, let's say, rationally hopeful because just now, as we are speaking, there are negotiations between the Prime Minister of the Romanian government and the trade union leaders.
These negotiations involve what precisely? Is the government prepared to back down on some of the proposals which have caused so much anger among the miners?
Not exactly. It depends on what have in mind the trade union leaders, because they announced three or four versions of their demands.
Well, could I ask you this then? Do you believe that what we are witnessing now is a political crisis or an industrial one?
It began like a trade union conflict, but since yesterday at least, it is a grave situation because the miners attacked the institutions of the state, meaning the police, the prefect, and some other representatives of the central government.
There were some very violent scenes. Is it your belief that what the miners want, or at least what their leaders want, is to force the downfall of the government?
It seems from time to time, yes. I cannot be extremely affirmative because I'm not there on the spot. But from time to time, some slogans are quite aggressive.
Is the government determined not to allow them to reach the capital, not to allow them to come onto the streets of Bucharest itself?
The government, the parliamentary parties, and the order forces are determined not to leave them to go on with their march, which is heavily costly, and it costs the health,
so
thank God not the life, of a lot of policemen.
So if these talks do not result in a negotiated solution, if the miners try once again to resume their journey towards the capital, the government will order the police to stop them, will it?
Yes, it's worse in a way than that. I mean, it's more severe, because the emergency can and will be declared.
Zoe Petra in Bucharest, thank you very much indeed. That was the presidential advisor speaking to us live from the Romanian capital. The messages coming out of today's meeting here in London of the six nations which are trying to find a way out of the crisis in Kosovo are mixed. On the one hand, the threat of NATO military action remains unless the Yugoslav president, Slobodan Milosevic, abandons his tough security policy in Kosovo, where the overwhelmingly ethnic Albanian population has been pressing for greater autonomy or even total independence from Serbia. On the other hand, there is a recognition by the major powers that military strikes are not in themselves a solution to the crisis. The British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook said that requires a political process.
Neither side is going to win this war. The Kosovo Liberation Army is not going to throw the Yugoslav army out of Kosovo, nor is the Yugoslav army going to be successful in a guerrilla war in circumstances in which, by repeated atrocity, they keep putting the whole population behind the guerrillas. There has to be a political process. Now, that's what today's meeting of the contact group is about.
Well, our political correspondent Barnaby Mason is following today's meeting of the contact group, at which Britain, the US, France, Germany, Italy and Russia are all represented. He joins me now. Barney, Mr. Cook talks about a political process. What exactly do they have in mind?
It's hard to make out in with any precision, Robin, but what seems to be the case is that they're talking about some sort of initiative to try and get the two sides together. They've failed completely to do that over the last few months. They will add some finishing touches to the plan drawn up by an American negotiator for a fair degree of autonomy for Kosovo, but it's a plan which had already been rejected by both sides. There may be an invitation issued from this meeting to, first of all, the ethnic Albanian side and then the Belgrade government, followed by a foreign minister's meeting, and then perhaps they hope some talks. But it's all a bit, it all seems a bit hypothetical while the present crisis continues.
And the threat of NATO strikes, I mean, that's something being held in reserve for now, is it? There's no talk of it being imminent.
It doesn't seem to be imminent, at least as far as British officials are concerned. The build-up towards possible military action is continuing, but it seems to be a fairly slow timescale. And, of course, the American Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, is also planning to be in Europe towards the end of next week. So I think for the moment they're going to see if they can make any progress on the political front while continuing to say that airstrikes are a possibility. But the difficulty is that everybody has grave doubts about the result of airstrikes, whether they would completely wreck the chance of a political solution, and what good they would in fact do.
One has the impression sometimes, doesn't one, that the idea of airstrikes comes about simply because they can't think of anything else.
Well, yes, and also because, you know, they had an agreement which Richard Holbrooke, the American envoy, negotiated with President Milosevic last October, and that agreement is quite clearly being defied by Belgrade. So the Americans in particular are insisting that it's not enough for Mr. Milosevic just to take back his decision to expel the head of the monitoring mission. He must do all the things he promised to do before. Now, if that's the case, they presumably come up against the problem. Having made the threats, they have to carry them through. The question is, do they get to that point where they think, even though we don't think it's a good idea, We think we're just going to have to do it to demonstrate that NATO means something.
In the past, when there have been crises involving President Milosevic, Russia has often been regarded as perhaps closer to him than the other major powers. I mean, is there an attempt this time as well to use the Moscow corridor, as it were, to get messages through to him?
Well, they're certainly listening to the messages that the deputy Russian foreign minister, Alexander Avdeyev, will have brought back from President Milosevic. He's one of the many people who've seen the Yugoslav president in the last couple of days. He emerged briefly about half an hour ago to say that the talks were going well, that they were trying to establish the basis for a foreign minister's meeting. There was quite a lot of hope being placed in the Russians on the question of resolving the immediate impasse over the head of the monitoring mission. But of course, I don't know that they can rely on the Russians to get Mr. Milosevic to comply on all the fronts that the Americans want. The Americans are talking very tough. They seem to be tougher than the Europeans on airstrike, but of course they don't want to have to put troops on the ground in, and many people think that unless that was going to be done, you can't really find a solution.
Barnaby Mason, for now, thank you. Two journalists in Zimbabwe have been talking publicly for the first time about the way they were tortured while they were in military custody. Mark Chavanduka, the editor of the Standard newspaper, and his senior reporter, Ray Chotto, were arrested in connection with a report about an alleged plot for a military coup. The Zimbabwean authorities have remained largely silent about the matter, except to issue a brief denial of any ill treatment. Our correspondent in Harare, Grant Ferret, has been hearing the journalist's story.
I must tell you before we start that we have received a very disturbing.
There was a subdued atmosphere as the two journalists prepared to speak publicly about their experiences for the first time, not least because of reports that the military was again seeking their detention. Clearly shaken by more than a week of interrogation by the military, during which he was denied access to lawyers, family or friends, Mark Chavanduka recounted his ordeal.
The multiple bruises on my back, the swelling on my arms is the result of the handcuffs and of the assaults, and there's blackening all over my body from the electric shocks.
What did they do to you?
There's a lot of interrogation, electrocution, physical assaults, and we were made to roll in the water all night. At times the assaults would take place until 5 o'clock in the morning. Basically what they were trying to establish is the sources of our information, and also to establish a link between us and the South African military.
His colleague, Ray Chotto, gave similarly chilling details of his 2 days in detention.
At times they would use the electric shock. After that they would clip us using wooden planks. And at times they would ask me to dip my head in a water bag. Sometimes I would be asked to lie on my back, and they would apply electric shock on my body. Like on Tuesday, I recall very well that I broke the handcuff because the pain was so much that I managed to break the handcuff. When they saw that, they said, "This man seems to be very strong. Let's use more painful tactics so that we really get it on."
Mr. Chotto held up his clearly swollen hands, the result, he said, of being repeatedly stamped on by his interrogators. He and Mark Chavanduka said they feared for their lives and were left in no doubt that knowledge and approval of their treatment went all the way to the top.
They said that if they didn't get the information that they wanted, they could kill us. And they said that everything that they were doing was with the blessing of the head of state, and they mentioned him by name, and they actually went as far as saying that he had actually signed our death warrants. And they said that they deliberately kept the police out because they were not interested in the due process of law. They're not interested in the courts. They were going to do things their own way.
Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have been fierce in their condemnation of the Zimbabwean authorities. And local activists like Isaac Maposa, who are campaigning for constitutional change, say they've all but given up hope that such a transformation can take place under the existing government.
The present government is not interested in a peaceful transitional process that will bring this country to a healthy political, social and economic order. It's very clear that the constitution they are using is completely that of the military. It's now a military rule where the army has total control and they can do as they wish. Indeed, we're in a state of emergency.
Over the past week, ministers and senior civil servants have repeatedly failed to appear before a judge to explain their actions. Attempts to contact the government today for its side of the story have proved fruitless, beyond a brief denial by an unnamed spokesman.
Grant Ferret reporting from Harare. Coming up next, the latest from Washington on the progress of the impeachment trial of President Clinton and why teams of Western doctors are preparing to undertake hundreds of operations in the developing world to help children to smile again. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Lustig. This is NewsHour. A reminder of the main headline. The Romanian president has suspended his threat to impose a state of emergency as the confrontation continues between the government and thousands of striking coal miners. In Washington, phase one of the impeachment trial of President Clinton has now ended. Phase two will start within the next few hours. And already the debate is over how much longer this extraordinary trial should go on. That decision will probably be taken early next week. But first, the jury, the 100 members of the US Senate, who will be deciding whether or not to remove the president from office, will have an opportunity to participate themselves in the proceedings. Claire Balderson is in Washington.
Later today, senators get the chance to ask questions to both the prosecution and defense teams. They still won't be able to speak. The questions will all be written down and handed to Judge William Rehnquist. Republicans are saying that they hope the questions can be used to rebut some of the comments made by the defense team during their presentation. But Democrats are saying the defense case was so strong, there's little point in proceeding much further with the trial. So how well did the defense do when they had the floor of the Senate for 3 days this week? I've been talking to Alan Barron, a lawyer who acted as prosecutor during the impeachment trials of two federal judges in the 1980s.
I think they did extremely well. I was particularly impressed with Mr. Ruff's presentation. There was a certain quiet elegance and a certain gravitas to the way he presented the case on behalf of the president. I have to admit at the outset, I know Mr. Ruff and I've been a fan of his for a long time and he is a friend. I think he put the case well. You then went to more detailed sort of picking apart of the facts, which is appropriate in a case in where accusations such as this are being made. I thought that Mr. Kendall did a good job, more of that sort of picking things apart. And former Senator Bumpers at the end was sort of a bit of a stem winder, kind of wrap it up with a bit of an emotional appeal. I don't think anybody's minds was changed about this. I really do not believe that. It is possible that perhaps Bumpers' appeal to the Senate, speaking as a former senator, to the senators in their capacity as senators, not as Republicans or Democrats, may sway one or two people who are teetering to remind them. He reframed the argument. He said it's really not about William Clinton as an individual. It is about the presidency of the United States. It is about affecting the balance of power among the branches of government if you are prepared to remove an enormously popular president by 67 individuals. It's an astounding thought. 67 people can overturn the votes of 50 million people.
But do you think those people were listening to the evidence in such detail that they were thinking, oh yes, that answers the prosecution's allegation on this, that, or the other?
I would like to believe that minds were open enough to be prepared to change their position if they believed that the evidence that the House managers had presented had been sufficiently undermined. Unfortunately, this is ultimately a political process, and I don't mean that in an entirely negative sense at all. There may be people who feel that what the president did was bad enough that they are politically justified in removing him.
There has been all the way through this, both the prosecution's case and the defense case, senators and members of the House talking about the need to call witnesses. This has become one of the big issues. Has anything we've heard in the past few days changed people's minds on that, or are we still looking at the possibility of witnesses, Monica Lewinsky herself, being paraded in front of the Senate?
Well, I think there is a pretty high likelihood that witnesses, perhaps on a limited basis, but that some live witnesses will be called. I base that on the fact that even some moderate Republicans, such as Senator Chafee of Rhode Island, is still saying he feels a need for live witnesses. Well, if he is saying it, you have to believe that a great many of the Republican senators who are not as moderate as he in their political views still want to hear from witnesses.
There's now, over the next few days, the chance for senators to ask questions. How is that going to work, and what sort of an impact do you think it'll have?
Well, it's going to be a very peculiar process. Think about it. Number one, the questions will be written out, which is a very odd way to question anybody. So it will not allow for very much opportunity for what you think of as follow-up questions, which would respond to the answer from whoever was answering the question. The process will call for one Republican question, then a Democrat question, back and forth, sort of like a tennis game. They are not asking questions of anyone who has any personal knowledge of any of the facts. The questions will be put in written form to individuals who have studied the record.
So what's the point?
Well, a nice question. I think it may call for, if they felt there was ambiguity in the argument put forth, or weakness, to some extent this is a chance, for example, for the managers to try to rebut the case that was put on by the president's counsel. Well, why didn't you, you know, what's your answer to this point? And maybe that'll be addressed to Mr. Ruff or Mr. Kendall. It is a way for them to test their mettle, so to speak. But I'm not sure it's really going to move the ball very far. I'm sure that many of these questions are calculated simply to rejuvenate the same issues, the same confrontations that have already taken place over the last 6 days.
We're hearing more and more that a majority of the politicians want this to be over because perhaps they realize that President Clinton is the person who's gaining most while they are tied up in the Senate with this. But how can they make it be over? Can they just go ahead and vote on the articles of impeachment?
Oh, they could. They could. I mean, any time somebody could, a single senator could seek to move to adjourn the trial, and a simple majority vote could control that. A simple majority could call the question, in effect, to vote on the articles up and down. It's not going to happen that crudely.
Lawyer Alan Barron. Questions are expected to last throughout Friday and Saturday. Next week, there'll almost certainly be that all-important vote on whether or not witnesses will be called. But for now, from Washington, back to the studio in London.
Claire Balderson, thank you. It's time now for the sports news, so let's go over to our sports unit and join Ed Harry.
A second member of the International Olympic Committee has resigned over the Salt Lake City bribery scandal. Libya's Bashir Mohamed Atirabulsi has stepped down just a day before the IOC meets to conclude the biggest corruption crisis in Olympic history. His son received tuition fees at schools in Utah and was paid $700 a month expenses. Seven more IOC members face possible expulsion unless they stand down, and four others face warnings for minor violations. The man heading the inquiry, Dick Pound, has dismissed suggestions that the IOC's president, Juan Antonio Samaranch, should also be asked to go.
I see no reason for it. You shouldn't compare the IOC to a corporate model where there's the ritual slaughter of the president when something goes wrong. I mean, this is an international organization whose members live all over the world, who meet together only once a year. It's a different kind of organization, but nevertheless, it has very high internal standards, and we've hoped for years to find some evidence of improper conduct so we could deal with it and send the message that we simply will not tolerate it. And we'll do that.
Five seeded players have been knocked out on the fifth day of the Australian Open Tennis Championships in Melbourne. In the ladies' event, number three seed Jana Novotna, the Wimbledon champion, lost in straight sets. Out two went number nine seed Conchita Martinez, also a former Wimbledon champion, and Natalia Zareva, seeded 15. In the men's event, third seed Pat Rafter was the main casualty, the US Open champion losing to Thomas Enquist in front of his home fans, while British interest ended with defeat for sixth seed Tim Henman. Andre Agassi, the fifth seed, is now the highest-ranked survivor in the men's draw, and not surprisingly, the favourite for the title. In the ladies' singles, world number one Lindsay Davenport went through to the fourth round today. In cricket, the choice of umpires is dominating discussion ahead of Sri Lanka's latest Tri-Nations match against England in Adelaide. The Sri Lankan off-spinner Muthiah Muralitharan, who bowls with a bent arm due to a birth defect, will come face-to-face with two of the umpires who called him for throwing on the tour to Australia 3 years ago. His bowling action has since been cleared by the IOC, but Murali has been repeatedly taunted by crowds on this tour shouting no ball after every delivery. The bowler says it's affected his performances, and the former Australian captain Ian Chappell has come out in his support.
Well, I'm not a political person. I really don't know what goes on in the corridors of power, but I have a sneaking suspicion what goes on there. That's why I think you'll probably find in Adelaide that Muralitharan will be passed. He'll be okay, I hope.
You do hope for...
I do hope, yeah.
On a human basis, you mean?
On all counts. I mean, one, because I don't think that he gains any unfair advantage, and two, because I think, the guy's been persecuted enough.
The former Australian captain, Ian Chappell, and that's the sport.
Ed, thank you. A team of plastic surgeons are due to be setting out from Britain, the US and Canada within the next few weeks to take part in a remarkable charity operation called A World Journey of Hope. They'll be operating on hundreds of children in the developing world who were born with severe facial deformities, which can be treated only by surgery. Dr. Phil McDonald is a British anaesthetist who will be leading a 40-strong team to the Philippines. I asked him what he expects to find when they arrive.
Initially, when we get there, we'll go out to a site in Davao in southern Philippines on one of the islands, and we'll initially be doing a clinic for approximately 2 days. We expect in those 2 days probably to screen 600 patients who will have come from all over that particular island.
And what kinds of conditions would you expect them to be suffering from?
The main condition that we're concentrating on is facial deformities, and most of the patients will have either cleft lips or cleft palates.
These are deformities with which they were born, are they generally?
Yes, they're congenital deformities that they're born with. Other areas that we often see on these trips is a lot of burns, facial burns, and this is sort of very deforming and also makes it difficult for the children to eat, breathe and talk.
Are these conditions which, generally speaking, would not be treated unless you and your colleagues in an operation of this kind were to be available?
Yes, this is a problem that in places like the Philippines, infrastructure and the skill base there in the hospitals is such that they can't do all these cases. Although they're very disfiguring, the cleft lips, they're often very normal children, and it means that they often don't get normal nutrition because they have difficulty eating, and also because it's embarrassing for the family, they may not actually sort of integrate into society, whereas this very simple operation will in fact mean that they can lead a perfectly normal life.
There are always, of course, very difficult questions of prioritising in any area of medicine, but I mean, let me put it to you this way. Mostly these conditions are not life-threatening. In countries which have an underdeveloped medical infrastructure, how do you justify concentrating on this kind of cosmetic surgery when the kinds of resources which are available perhaps could be put to better use by treating more serious life-threatening conditions?
Well, in actual fact, that's not entirely accurate because just from what I said before, they are in a way almost life-threatening. Someone who's got a severe cleft palate or severe lip, as I say, will not be able to eat adequately, and they often die when they're actually quite young. And you've got to bear in mind that these are normal children. I do understand what you're saying about where you should prioritise, but we also, Operation Smile, whenever it goes to a country, has a commitment of a minimum of 5 years to go to the same site every year, and the idea is that we actually try and educate the local surgeons and local anaesthetists, local nurses, how to actually perform the operation. A large part of the actual mission is actually educating.
And who is funding the work that you're going to be doing?
It's coming all from charities based in the United States. The charity has been going for quite a number of years now, Operation Smile, and they've had a number of fairly large grants this year, and also they basically just fundraising virtually entirely from the States. And I think the whole Operation Smile budget for the year this year is in the region of $7 or $8 million.
With which you are going to bring a lot of happiness to a lot of young people.
Well, we hope we're going to bring a lot of happiness to not only to the children, but also to their families, so that these children can just live a perfectly normal life.
The British anaesthetist, Dr. Phil McDonald. Just time before we go to bring you some news just in from Moscow. It's been announced there that it's been decided that the space station Mir, now a venerable 13 years old, should remain in orbit for another 3 years until the year 2002. It's not going to die yet. That's all from this edition of NewsHour. For now, from me, Robin Lustig, in London, and everyone on the programme team, goodbye.